Hello, everyone. This is Mihai Jaino, and you're listening to the New Books in African American Studies podcast. Today, we have as our guest Professor Adam Ewing, author of The Age of Garvey, How a Jamaican Activist Created a Mass Movement and Changed Global Black Politics, published by Princeton University Press. Professor Ewing, welcome.
Great to be here.
I wonder if you'd begin by saying a few words about yourself, in particular, how you became a historian, or perhaps how you came to your current professional position.
Yeah, so I was fascinated in history for as long as I can remember. I remember very distinctly taking Canadian history when I was in grade seven. I grew up in Toronto with Miss Raybeck, and being just dazzled by what the past could teach us, and that idea always really stuck with me and never left. In terms of veering towards African American and African diasporic history, there were two really important aspects of that. First the stories that always really drew me or compelled me in history were the stories of social protest or the stories of those that were dispossessed or disempowered to seek to gain or acquire power to challenge those in power. And African American and later African diaspora history fit really well into or told a lot of stories to that effect. And the other thing was I read the autobiography of Malcolm X when I was in high school, and that more than any other book really affected my thinking and shifted me really finally toward African American studies and to thinking about issues of race and empowerment surrounding that question of race. And then as I got further into my studies, I became really interested in the diaspora and thinking about how the experiences of African Americans really were part of a global story that included people of black skin and people of all colors all over the world as they sought to negotiate ideas about race and ideas about power and land and all of those ideas about gender and class and all of it seemed very very connected and important to tell those stories together. So that's how I got on my current course. I did my graduate work in I got an MA at the University of South Carolina. I did a PhD at Harvard, and now I'm teaching at Virginia Commonwealth University.
Very, very interesting. I like that trajectory started in grade seven in Toronto.
It's very specific.
That's right. Well, if only because I spent grade seven in Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, so I know what a pivotal moment that can be. So that's great. Well, if you could tell us how you actually came to write The Age of Garvey, that would be great.
Sure. So I stumbled upon Garveyism by accident. I'd come to graduate school interested in studying grassroots political organizing on the west side of Chicago in the 1950s and 1960s. And in my first year, I was taking a class with my dissertation advisor, Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham. And I decided to write a term paper, a research paper on Garveyism, because I was really interested in what I think is the most important aspect of Garvey, which is that he was just a brilliant organizer and really had a keen sense of how to draw people toward him and toward his project. And I was interested, more broadly speaking, for this Chicago project that was later discarded, in the way in which local political projects and national or global political ideologies become aligned, in the way in which those broader ideas catalyze and encourage political activity out of local communities. And Garveyism seemed like a fruitful place to look for that. When I started studying Garveyism, I fell in love with the complexity and power of the movement. And I also was amazed to discover that although there's been some really great work done on Garveyism, particularly in the last years since I began the project, there's been a number of really excellent studies that have appeared. Despite that, Garveyism still remains remarkably underrepresented in mainstream narratives. Garveyism is treated by its most celebrated biographers in mainstream circles very critically. And it was remarkable to me, this contradiction between this movement that people generally recognize was one of the most important movements in the history of the African diaspora on the one hand, and on the other hand, really wasn't receiving the attention or theoretical care that other aspects of African American and African diasporic history were being given. And I wanted to really try to unpack that paradox and also to make a contribution that would bring Garveyism into the story that people think about when they think about this history in a meaningful way.
That's great. So, if we could sort of go into that a little bit more, and if you could provide perhaps your understanding of Garveyism, right? Both you note in your introduction that it's an organic mass politics as well as a sustained project of identity building. And I'm wondering how that definition differs from sort of a more traditional definition.
Yeah, so I think that the way that people typically think about Garveyism centers around a lot of the most loud and you know, for good reason, you know, the most politically radical, bombastic, explosive elements and brief elements of Garvey and his organization, the Universal Negro Improvement Association's heyday. So people generally tell the story with Garvey. And Garvey is, I should say, a fascinating figure that deserves a lot of attention in his own right. But narratives generally, particularly in kind of the broader conceptualization of the relationship between Garveyism and the broader history, tend to focus on Garvey's story, which is situated almost exclusively in these renderings in Harlem, which are focused around the big, ambitious projects that Garvey launched in his early career. The Black Star Line, most famously a shipping line that sought to connect West Africa, the Caribbean, and the United States, and to pool the economic resources of people of African descent around the world. A lot of attention is focused on this notion that Garveyism was a so-called Back to Africa movement, and that central to its politics was establishing a beachhead in Liberia, which was certainly an important part of Garvey's project for a while, but his relationship to Africa was much more complicated than that. And it also tends to dwell a lot on Garveyism as an ideology. And Garveyism gets wrapped up in debates, particularly within African-American history, about the value of separatism, the value of Black nationalism, debates between integrationists and nationalists, instead of drawing back and looking at what I think are much more interesting questions about the relationship that Garveyism has to a much longer and more globally expansive organizing tradition, an idea of identity that people of African descent carried to Africa, the Caribbean, to Central America, to the Americas, which is the idea of Pan-Africanism and the idea that people that have Black skin or that are descended from Africa have a common destiny, and from this from that perspective, I think Garveyism much more accurately explains, you know, how people of African descent and people around the world became organized under this sign, and provides a much different picture than those that would question the merits of whether, for example, Garveyites should engage with the courts or should in the United States or should disengage. It provides a much broader perspective that casts those debates between the NAACP, for example, and the UNIA in a much different light.
Interesting. Yeah, and so the first part of the part one, rather, of your book is the rise and fall of Marcus Garvey, and we'll get into part two, which sort of talks more about the age of Garvey, which I think is more closely related to the point you just made. But in that first chapter, you also take some time to distinguish between between Pan-Africanism as well as Garveyism. And so I wonder if you could help us understand, again, the sort of distinctions that you might be making between those two.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that Garveyism has a really interesting place in the context of a history of Pan-Africanism, and I argue in the first chapter that in order to understand the emergence of Garveyism, you really need to understand what was happening in the 19th century. You really need to take first of all, a global perspective, and you also need to understand that I think we often have a sense, a Whiggish perspective of history that we've come in this country, in this world, from a perspective where slavery was sanctioned to a place where African nations emerged, where the civil rights movement produced important victories, and that we're slowly climbing out of this hole of racial exclusion. When in fact, throughout the 19th century, we went from a period around the mid-century when there was really a lot of hope for the idea that if we weren't going to think about people of African descent on an equal playing field at that moment, that there was at least a very powerful kind of liberal sense that all people were created equal, that all people had a right to certain protections. And this was played out in the West African colonies in Britain, in the Jamaican, or in the Caribbean colonies, the British Caribbean colonies, and in the United States during the period of Reconstruction. And slowly this idea that there was that there would be a place for people of African descent in this new liberal post-emancipation order disappeared, and what emerged by the turn of the century, with the scramble for Africa and changing legal restrictions in the across the colonial landscape, and with the institution of Jim Crow in the United States, was a very different world indeed. When a lot of the assumptions that have been made by Pan-Africanists, those people of African descent that have been influenced by Christianity, who believed that the African race had a providential destiny and particularly the people that had been taken to the New World in bondage had been done so to execute a divine purpose, that they had been given certain gifts or given certain tools that they would then take back to Africa and redeem it. That ideology that had guided Pan-Africanists throughout Africa, the Caribbean, and the United States took on a very different meaning in this new 20th century world, when the expectation in the past had been that educated people of African descent and Westerners would cooperate in the regeneration of the continent. And I should say that on both sides of this equation, there was a notion of Africa that was based on this notion of civilizational chauvinism or Western superiority that both black and white people in this tradition shared. But we went from this period where there was this notion that this was going to be a shared project of emancipating Africa, to a realization by the turn of the century, and particularly by the end of World War I, that black people were on their own, and that more broadly, people of color were not going to be offered the freedoms that European descended people had promised them was the end goal of the so-called civilizing mission. And so Garveyism grew out of an expectation that Africa would be redeemed out of this really old idea that people of African descent that had been scattered by the slave trade were actually a unified people that had a providential destiny in Africa and elsewhere, and added an extra layer of cynicism about the ability or the willingness of people with white skin to recognize their humanity and recognize their rights. And Garveyism really took that material and translated into the explosive movement that emerged after World War One.
Interesting. Yeah, and one of the things I really, and one of the lines that I really enjoy in the book is that you talk about how Garvey sort of embraces biblical prophecy in the present tense, right? And slightly before that, and more to the point that you just made, as he becomes radicalized in part by his affiliation with Hubert Harrison and Liberty League and so on, this idea of the new Negro that marks the end of this era of compromise, right? This sort of maybe which coincides with this disillusionment about what had been promised, you know, as against what's, you know, what is emerging as reality, and the beginning of a more open militancy. I wonder if you could say more about how that plays out.
Yeah, sure. So Garveyism, as I said, emerged out of this Pan-African tradition, and Garvey grew up in an environment where he was exposed to a number of these key Pan-African and you know, Black intellectual thinkers. So he grew up reading people like Kaisley Hayford in the Gold Coast, and reading the work of Booker T. Washington, and reading the work of Edward Blyden from Liberia and Sierra Leone, and grew up, you know, as a young man, worked for someone that people don't know a lot about, Duze Muhammad Ali, who was a really influential editor of a journal called The African Times and Orient Review, based out of London. And the general thrust of this intellectual community's argument was both warning, you know, both sent a warning to whites that they needed to get their acting gear and start living up to their promises, their kind of the liberal democratic traditions that they touted, and also a real belief that there were ways to work within those channels to convince white people to recognize their humanity. And this is seen very clearly in the writing of W.E.B. Du Bois, who, you know, in most famously in The Souls of Black Folk, is making a very direct appeal that Europeans, that white Americans allow people of color to be, as he put it, co-workers in the kingdom of culture, to be participants in this intellectual and political and social global project. And you know, when World War One started, there was great optimism in a number of different circles that this was a moment, this was a key moment when people of African descent could prove finally their worth. African Americans, Afro-Caribbeans, Africans, these arguments were made in India by people like Gandhi, that by serving the Allied cause, defeating the threat of German autocracy, and by holding Europeans and Americans and the Allied powers to the promises of their rhetoric. You know, this was a time when Woodrow Wilson, the president of the United States, was declaring that the Allies were making the world safe for democracy. Wilson and the British Prime Minister David Lloyd George adopted a term that Lenin had used in the midst of the Russian Revolution, self-determination, and declared that this was a war for the self-determination of peoples to determine their own destiny. And people of African descent and people of color, indeed, all over the world, took these pronouncements literally, or at least adopted them as a way of throwing it in the face of the Allied leaders and saying, look, you can't say that you're doing this and then not offer these rights to us who are dying for the cause that you've asked us to die for. So as Du Bois famously put it during World War II, during World War One, he asked African Americans to close ranks, to serve the Allied cause, to fight the war, and then demand freedoms after the war was over. And something very different, of course, happened. African American soldiers and Afro-Caribbean soldiers and African soldiers returned home to discover that not only were they not going to receive self-determination as Wilson had declared, not only were they going to see democratic reforms, but that they were perceived by a threat by their respective states, who were very, very nervous about what it meant that that African American and African descended men were marching off to war and coming home with new ideas and new experiences. And lynchings spiked, race riots spiked throughout the United States, most famously in East St. Louis, but also after the war in places like Washington and Chicago. And this did a lot of things. It radicalized people of African descent all over the world, but it also did a lot to discredit the ideas of this cadre of leadership, the W.E.B. Du Boises, and others who had cautioned people of African descent to be patient and to receive their just rewards after the war. And it gave a lot of political capital to people like Hubert Harrison, who was very influential to Garvey, and Garvey himself, who had begun arguing in 1917, and for people like Harrison much earlier, that this was a trap, that people of African descent needed to stop pleading with whites for their just rewards, but to start demanding them and to start letting go of the idea that the path to liberation could be paved through the good intention of people of European descent, but instead must be won through struggle and through an uncompromising demand for Black humanity, and so it was absolutely crucial.
So then this sort of opens the way for the sort of armed self-defense of the 1920s that you discuss in your third chapter, and this sort of moment of radical Garveyism.
So I think. There's this really important moment right after the war, and a lot of really good scholars have written about this moment in different parts of the world. Most notably, Erez Manella, in a book called The Wilsonian Moment, where there's this period from 1918 and particularly in 1919, where the world was absolutely on fire. Europe lay in shambles as a result of the war. There were anti-colonial protests erupting in places like India and Korea and Egypt and China, and in the Caribbean. There were wave after wave of strikes across all continents, but also in the United States. And there was a real sense among people like Garvey and the people that were drawn to Garvey's movement that this was the moment of reckoning for European civilization, that the war had been a catastrophic error, that this was a moment when people of color could seize their opportunity and demand liberation from what had emerged by World War I as a global system of white supremacy. And Garveyism rose on that wave and was able to catalyze that wave and help spark a lot of the unrest that emerged throughout the United States, particularly throughout the Caribbean, and also through West Africa and to a lesser extent in East Africa and Southern Africa.
Interesting. So another thing that you point out in that same third chapter is that Garveyism's transmission to Africa was not as explosive as it had been in the Caribbean, and I'm wondering if you could sort of talk about how a sort of race first politics articulates itself in an African context.
Yeah, so it was. I think it was less explosive in Africa because of the conditions on the ground there and because of the difficulty of transmitting Garveyism. I think it's an important point in general is to recognize that one of the reasons why Garveyism was so successful was not because it broadcast a defiant and uncompromisingly radical message, which is something that I, as I just mentioned, it, Garveyites did in the early years of their organization, from the United States. It was successful because Garveyism, like the Pan-African ideologies before it, was inherently malleable and very much geared toward giving people a set of tools that they could then adapt to fit their political circumstances. Garveyism was very quickly banned throughout most of Africa. The Garvey organ, the Negro World, was banned. Organizational manifestations of the movement was banned in West Africa. To possess a copy of the Negro World was punishable by death. And so Garveyism traveled the way a lot of political ideas traveled during interwar period in Africa, when political dissent and political organizing in general was very difficult, particularly outside of West Africa and South Africa, by movement of ideas and carried by Black people who had been thrown into this global economic world, way of supremacy that cast people of African descent around the world. So people throughout Africa traveled vast distances to work on European farms and to work in mines and to work in various industries that supported colonial regimes. There was a thick network of Black sailors that had long existed that helped carry the message of Garveyism and other political ideas both to Africa and through Africa. And so the movement and the ideas of Garveyism spread remarkably quickly, despite the political sensitivity of those ideas and the difficulty of spreading those ideas. And they had different effects in different places. In Kenya, as I talked a little bit about in chapter 3, the ideas of Garveyism, along with other anti-colonial ideas, including the ideas emerging from the anti-colonial movement in India, helped catalyze what could have emerged as a major anti-colonial challenge, but was foiled before it could spiral out of control. In other places, the ideas of Garveyism had a really important influence on, for example, the formative years of the African National Congress in South Africa, the National Congress of British West Africa in the British African colonies, and in those places, particularly in West Africa, activists there on the ground were both intensely inspired by Garvey's message and inspired by this idea that people all over the Black world were mobilizing under similar signs. They were building their strength. They were preparing to ultimately unseat colonial rule and European supremacy of Africa. They were inspired by this, but they were also in many ways skeptical of parts of Garvey's message, and they took parts of the program that they liked. For example, the Black Star Line was incredibly popular in West Africa, and they rejected other parts of the message that they didn't think was feasible in their environments. So in West Africa, there was a lot of skepticism about Garvey's bombast and his radical demands that Europeans leave Africa right away in the early period. It wasn't politically feasible to have those ideas. So they rejected those ideas. They took the broader movement as a great inspiration. And they also made a claim that Garveyism, if it was to work, needed to be spearheaded by local people, by Africans themselves. And this is a message that Garvey eventually learned himself. He began with a sense that Western Blacks like himself would return to Africa and lead Africa out of the darkness. But he came to have a much greater appreciation for for the politics and the cultural integrity and importance of Africans themselves as spearheads and leaders of the movement that he was the inspirational force behind.
I'll definitely want to come back to some of that because your chapter six sort of talks in part about the some of the religious movements in Southern and Central Africa that through which a Garveyist discourse can be observed. But before that, at the end of the first part of the book, we're talking about the 1920, 1921, you're seeing both the sort of explosive growth of the UNIA, several hundred chartered divisions, the circulation of Negro World has tripled, I believe. And within a year, in 1922, Garvey's arrested and the UNIA's imperial aspirations and dreams sort of come crashing down. You note that this sort of paradoxically makes room for the rise of the Age of Garvey. And I wonder if you can do two things. One is to sort of talk about what the Age of Garvey is, right? To some extent, it's coterminous with the interwar period, but it's more than that. And I wonder if you could also sort of talk about W.E.B. Du Bois and his... his sort of take on Garvey's demise.
So, as you say, I think this is one of the most important arguments that I make in the book, which is that the moment when Garvey's demise was being broadcast by people like Du Bois, who declared in 1923, that African Americans survived the twin temptations of Booker T. Washington and Marcus Garvey unscathed. From this moment, when people were declaring Garvey's demise, was actually the moment in which Garvey was able to refashion his organization and refashion the purpose of Garveyism in a way that really became his legacy. As you say, Garvey fell upon some pretty hard times by 1922. And I describe a moment where in 1921, where Garveyism really stands at what seems to be an apex, and then very quickly declines. Not only is Garvey was Garvey arrested, but the Black Star Line declared bankruptcy. His schemes to set up a beachhead in Liberia ended in failure, and what happened in a general sense was that Garvey's grand plan to be the president of Africa or to build this grand movement with a thriving shipping industry and all the trappings of statehood. Garvey imagined his organization as a government in exile and imagined himself within his lifetime, marching on to Africa and liberating the continent. In the space of a short time, all of those dreams came crashing down, and Garvey very, very pointedly redirected the focus of his organization away from direct incitement of white authorities, particularly in the United States, away from big picture projects, away from a centralized imagining of the UNIA, and instead started to decenter the thrust of the thrust of his organization to try to really focus on spreading, continuing the spread of Garveyism through agents, through his newspaper around the world, and to spread a message that was not Garvey is coming, but rather you need to take these tools and do with them what you can. You need to imbibe these broad principles of the organization, that we are a mighty race, that we do have a fundamental unity, that we will be redeemed. And it's a matter of institution building and consciousness raising and preparation for the next moment of opportunity. Because he argued that that the race had missed the opportunity of World War I. It was this invocation that that I argue came to define the age of Garvey and provided a remarkable space for a number of political projects that otherwise wouldn't have had that space. So the 1920s, for example, was a moment when the NAACP, which had reached, which had become a mass organization really for the first time, riding this wave of radicalism during and after World War I, was in sharp decline and had gone into retreat. And at the same time that the NAACP was retreating from Black communities, the UNIA was flourishing across the South in rural communities and in the heart of Jim Crow. Garvey's message was catalyzing political projects in Africa. It was at the center of labor organizing in the Caribbean. And the reason why I describe this as an age of Garvey is because I argue that it was this organizing tradition which built inextricably on the Pan-African traditions, the religious, the work of missionaries, the work of Black intellectuals that had come before Garvey. It worked through those channels, but it also transformed the ideas of Pan-Africanism into a workable and usable political tradition, or a set of political ideas and a set of political principles that could be and were applied by a remarkable number of people of African descent throughout the world, engaged in all kinds of different political projects, whether it was millennial religious revivalists in Central America or labor organizers in the Caribbean or small rural communities in the Jim Crow South, or so-called welfare association organizers in Central America. It had an incredible resonance and spoke directly to the needs of the moment in a way that no other political project did during this period.
Well, that brings us really nicely to the fifth chapter, which sort of talks about one of the more underappreciated aspects of the UNIA being this, what you call, and I'll quote directly, a sustained assault upon the ramparts of privilege within the Black community. And I wonder if you can say a bit more about that, as well as another aspect that was very, very interesting to me, which is the gendered constructions within the movement is another aspect that's also been largely overlooked.
Yeah, of course. So in that chapter, I'm talking about Garveyism in the United States, and as far as the class dynamic of Garveyism, I don't think this has gotten enough attention. In fact, Garveyism really and the UNIA really took advantage of an absence in particularly in northern communities in which during the period during and after World War I, thousands of migrants from the southern United States and as well as from the West Indies were streaming into these urban centers. And what they discovered were established organizations like the NAACP and particularly the Urban League, as well as established Black churches that really disdained these new migrants as credulous and uneducated and in need of uplift or in need of tutelage by middle class respectable African Americans like themselves. Recent migrants found very, very few opportunities for political leadership in these established institutions. And Garveyism provided a space for these people and also a very powerful message for them. Garvey declared that the only that aristocracy in the United in the Black community, that those that should be respected should not be respected based on their so-called respectability or on their level of educational attainment or based on the profession that they had, but on the service that they gave to the race, and rather self-servingly to the service that they gave to the UNIA. But what that meant was that anyone who had the investment and the willingness to give his or her life to the organization had an opportunity to rise to a position of leadership within the organization. And the UNIA provided remarkable opportunities both for those that did have quite a lot of education and were, you know, ministers and lawyers and doctors, but it also provided a great platform for leadership for washerwomen and longshoremen and a host of people that otherwise wouldn't have had these opportunities, and made a very different argument about respectability that cut across the old kind of African-American middle-class notions of respectability that imagined poor Black people much in the way that that white Americans did, as those that were debased and were in need of education and were not and were in some respects reserving of the scorn that white people were heaping on them, and more than that, making respectable African Americans look bad by comparison, because they were being lumped in with you know, with all Black people into an undifferentiated blob. So that was a very powerful message that Garvey was able to convey in the United States, and was crucial to his success in bringing people into the movement. As far as gender constructions within the movement go, it's a complicated story because Garveyites, like all Black nationalists, and indeed like all nationalist ideologies, have a tendency, and Garveyism was certainly reflected this tendency to present a masculinist discourse that privileged the reclamation of Black manhood, that asked women to be the mothers and nurturers of the race. Africa was portrayed as the motherland with all of the gendered associations that invoked, and so in terms of the official rhetoric of the UNIA, it was very much expected that women would be the so-called helpmeets of their men. They would train the sons of the race to become the great leaders of the race. And yet, at the same time, perhaps paradoxically, Garveyism and the UNIA provided remarkable opportunities for women to attain positions of leadership within the organization that were truly remarkable for the period. And I argue that what's important to keep in mind is that, and this is really central to my conceptualization of Garveyism in general, that it's one thing to view a movement by looking at its official rhetoric and by framing it by its ideology, what it produces. But it's really important, I think, to recognize, particularly when we look at mass movements, that within those movements, there is a lot of jostling going on among the participants. And what Garveyism was able to do, particularly because it was so decentralized, particularly because it gave so many new positions for leadership, was to provide a space within which both women and men of the movement could claim the movement for themselves and make arguments about the thrust of the movement for themselves. So you get things, you get examples within this ostensibly masculinist organization. You get this, for example, this remarkable page being edited by Garvey's wife, Amy Jakes Garvey, called "All Are Women and What They Think," which was a unreservedly feminist page that made a really, really far-reaching and interesting argument about the place of women within the organization, and more than that, the place of women within, you know, the Black world that was truly radical, that accepted certain aspects of the UNIA's message and had things like cooking recipes on it on the one hand, but also broadcast news about women leaders in all fields, hosted debates about the role of women in the movement, and more than that, presented women's issues as issues that were relevant to the whole race, and unambiguously presented women as important leaders within the movement. And those types of interventions happened in communities across the United States. It happened in local divisions as well as at the parent body. Women rose to positions of leadership and importance throughout the country on the backs of the UNIA in a way that was, you know, as I say, it was complicated, but it also reflects the extent to which these ideas, like they are in the broader society, are always up for grab and are being contested or being shaped by the participants rather than being fixed by the ideas themselves.
Well, and to your point about the sort of, I guess, diffuse nature of Garveyism and how it allows it, how that allows it to sort of get to unexpected places. In your chapter six, you sort of talk about how it, I don't know if permeates is the right word, but a series of religious movements in Southern and Central Africa. And I wonder if you can tell us more about this, the relationship in particular of the Watchtower movement and Garveyism. And if you could start by explaining what the Watchtower movement was.
Yeah, sure. So the Watchtower movement grew out of the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society, better known as the Jehovah's Witnesses, which were founded in the United States in the 19th century, and by the early 20th century had spread to Africa. The basic idea of the Jehovah's Witnesses at that time, or the Watchtower, was the notion that that Christ was coming to Earth in 1914, that it was the job of the Watchtower to spread this word, to not engage in politics, but to prepare as many people as possible for the coming of the millennium. And then after the millennium didn't come in 1914, the theology was changed to say that it wasn't that the millennium was going to come in 1914. It was that Christ had returned visibly to the earth in 1914, that the millennium would be revealed down the line. In Africa, the Watchtower movement was transformed in a very interesting way. A number of Africans took up the theology of the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society, and they imagined the millennium as being coterminous with the liberation of Africa from white rule. Again, they were doing this ostensibly apolitically. They were broadcasting this message through the church, but the line between the line between independent religious practice, particularly one so with such an explosive message, and political organizing in Africa was very hard to discern. And there were great explosions of anxiety and protest, particularly in 1908 and then again in World War II. The way that the Watchtower movement is connected to Garveyism is somewhat indirect, and I think it speaks to a really key argument that I try to make in the book, which is that when we're thinking about the relationship of diasporic ideas to political projects, we tend to give a lot of weight to the content of the ideas themselves and the people that are spreading the ideas themselves. And we give less attention to those people that are receiving these ideas and figuring out how to actually make them work for them, to make them, you know, to translate them into local contexts in which they are meaningful. And so Garveyism, the way as Garveyism spread across Africa in 1919 and 1920 and through the 1920s, in many places, it was carried through a series of rumors, or at least it became closely associated with a series of rumors about Black American liberators. And the way that the outlines of the rumor went was that African Americans or Black people in America were mobilizing their resources, either a fleet of ships or a fleet of airplanes, and gaining strength, and that imminently they would arrive in Africa, either in South Africa or Central Africa or wherever, and rain hellfire down upon the colonial regime, throw the Europeans out of Africa and inaugurate the millennium. So that was the way that Garveyism was imagined, as a far-off power that was mobilizing and preparing an assault. And the Watchtower movement picked up on this rhetoric, and they began to deploy the myth or the rumor of the Black American Liberator as a recruitment tool and as a way and as a way to test the mettle of the colonial state, which was both all powerful but also spread thinly on the ground and unable to actually exert a tremendous amount of resources to snuffing out these types of ideas. And so the relationship of Garveyism and the Watchtower took on a cast where the Watchtower were taking a mythological idea about Garveyism and translating it into a rhetorical device that allowed certain preachers to gain great followings and really pose interesting challenges to the state. When at the same time that these Watchtower preachers were operating, Garveyites themselves, those that were actually engaged in networks of communication that joined Garveyites in South Africa and Central Africa and the Caribbean and the United States, were actually trying to build a very different political project. So you have this strange situation where the Watchtower movement is, or Watchtower preachers, because the Watchtower movement was very diffuse, but certain Watchtower preachers were gaining great political capital from Garveyism at the same time that Garveyites in Africa were denigrating the Watchtower as not being true believers or effective purveyors of political consciousness.
Truly, yeah, that's very, very interesting. Because further to the point that you make about this meaningful translation to local context, I guess a comparable project that you discuss in the final chapter of the book is this, the Kikuyu nationalism that's sort of, that's often been characterized as you put it, as a sort of fictive unity, an invented tradition. This seems to borrow very directly from Garvey's development of, or invention, let's say, of a Negro race, right? And it seems to inspire Kikuyu Central Association activists to do the same thing for a Kikuyu nation. And I wonder if you can sort of talk about that and also, talk about the post-colonial African leaders and their acknowledgement, I guess, of their indebtedness, ideologically speaking, to Garvey.
Yeah. So in the final chapter of the book, I look at the way in which, as you say, Kikuyu local politics or Kikuyu political activists in central Kenya translate Garveyite ideas and a lot of other ideas as well into from a diasporic kind of pan-Black perspective or pan-African perspective into a notion of pan-ethnic Kikuyu unity. I think the way in which that happens speaks in very important ways to the reasons why Garveyism was influential and important in Africa during this period. Garveyite ideas first came to Kenya, as I mentioned earlier, through the protest movement led by Harry Thuku in the early 1920s. Thuku was a printer who became involved with anti-colonial politics among Kenyan Indians, and also became connected to a group of contacts in East Africa that were receiving messages and receiving information and papers about the Garvey movement, and were in conversation with Garveyites and other activists back in the United States. And this escalated into a movement in which Thuku traveled throughout the country, trying to mobilize people in a very aggressive way to stand up to and to defy British colonial power. And he was ultimately arrested and sent into exile. And that chapter of his movement declined. Those people that had been inspired by Thuku in the early 1920s essentially went underground after that. They continued to be inspired by the Pan-African ideas of Marcus Garvey. They continued to have the same anti-colonial perspective, but they also recognized that there was a real opportunity in the dynamics of indirect rule in Kenya to make very specific claims to leadership through a claim to so-called tribal authenticity and tribal leadership. And what Kikuyu activists started to do beginning in the early 20s, but particularly toward the end of the 1920s and the 1930s, was to use claims to cultural authenticity, to speaking to the real needs of their people within the reserves, within realms that had been set aside for African political leadership under the model of indirect rule. They began to make claims that started to look a lot like claims that Garveyites were making. And in fact, Kikuyu leaders were in active contact with Garveyites and other Pan-Africanists around the continent and in Europe as well. The crucial figure here is Jomo Kenyatta, who as a young man was fired by the ideas of Garvey and involved in the transmission of Garveyism, and later emerged as the head of this organization, at least the operational head of the organization, and very effectively translated this Pan-African politics that Garveyism was promoting into the politics of cultural nationalism, first in Kenya, then in Europe, and then later back in Kenya. And like Kenyatta, there were a number of figures throughout Africa that were similarly located in these Garvey networks. People like Nnamdi Azikiwe in Nigeria, who became the first president of independent Nigeria, or Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana. A number of leaders of the African National Congress, as I mentioned, in South Africa, and a number of people and leaders that are less well known, that during the period between the wars, when in places like Malawi or Zambia or Zimbabwe, there wasn't an opportunity to form political organizations. There wasn't an opportunity to express the type of dissent that these people wish to express. Garveyism provided a really important network, first of all, a channel to receive and share ideas, and it also provided an essential idea during this period that was, I think, really important in catalyzing political projects that on the face of it seemed rather locally situated, mundane, maybe not explosive or productive even, because they were very much focused on local issues on their face. Garveyism provided a powerful message that all of these activists held with them and helped spread, that this local work was part of a bigger project, that colonial rule had a shelf life, no matter how powerful it seemed in that moment, and that they were contributing by spreading word, by raising consciousness about these issues, by trying to build schools and churches and other institutions that would train a new generation of Black leadership. All of these ideas were both practical and enacted by African activists throughout the continent. And what you see when in the post-World War II period, the opportunities for politics really opened up and the situation changed, Kind of like Garvey said when he warned that African people needed to be prepared for the next moment of opportunity, the people that stepped into those opportunities were in many respects people that had come out of that Garveyite tradition. Mm-hmm. And a lot of credit is given in this transition to the intellectuals in the United States and particularly in Europe, the people like George Padmore and C.L.R. Mm-hmm. James, people that were really fashioning a new intellectual politics. And that transition toward a new type of assertive Pan-Africanism was really important, to be sure. But I think not enough attention is given to the painstaking organizing work that was happening on the ground during this period that laid a much richer foundation than those intellectual ideas for this new era in which those new ideas could really find fertile terrain.
That's very, very interesting. Let me ask you this. What might be the enduring legacy, if there is one, of Garveyism, in light of what you've just said?
I think Garveyism, you know, as I argue in the book, Garveyism is an absolutely essential component of the ongoing struggle of people of African descent to win a greater measure of freedom globally, to gain more political and economic power. It bridges a series of movements that aren't always thought of together. And most directly, Garveyism provided, as I said, a space for political organizing, particularly during a period from the early 1920s to World War II, and particularly during the 1920s, where there weren't a lot of opportunities for political organizing. Garveyism provided a space for people to gain and develop their political consciousness. It gave people a space to practice politics. And I think the best way to represent the legacy of Garveyism, because Garveyism is often cast in this rhetoric of defeat. You know, Garveyism mm-hmm. is this comet that emerges on the stage, kind of, excites a lot of people and then disappears. I think the best way to render the legacy of Garveyism is instead to look at the legacy of those, you know, daughters and sons who grew up in the Garvey movement and then fanned out into all kinds of different organizations after the war, not only in nationalist organizations in Africa, but in radical trade union movements and nationalist mm-hmm. movements in the Caribbean, in nearly every important African American organization in the 1930s and 1940s and 1950s and 1960s. There are important figures who grew up in the Garvey movement or who were inspired by Garvey, who learned lessons about organizing from Garveyism, which was the most successful mass movement that most people had ever seen. And that legacy really, I think, speaks to the importance of looking at this politics as a continuum and looking at the practice of politics and the practice of those who seek to challenge relations of power as being an ongoing process, one that's always partial, that's never complete, that kind of goes up and down, but that isn't predicated on an intellectual arc or on mm-hmm. An arc that would seek to kind of solve an intellectual problem, but in fact engages people in a constant struggle in which the status quo is being challenged. And from that perspective, Garveyism, you know, was the dominant politics of this period during the interwar period, and needs to be acknowledged as such.
Well, thanks for that answer, and thank you for spending this time speaking with us about your book. As I mentioned, I really enjoyed gaining a broader perspective on Garvey through your work, and I'm very interested to know what you might be working on now.
Yeah, so I'm embarking on what I'm describing as a history of rumor in the African diaspora. So I'm interested in asking a lot of the questions that I began to try to answer with my book on Garveyism. But most importantly, how can we think about diasporic politics in a way that both is sensitive to local communities of struggle, and which also allows non-elites to become the center of the story? And I think there are a lot of important lessons that can be learned by looking at more informal forms of speech acts and the way in which ideas about the world around these communities are inspired by often anti-intellectual or differently registered ideas. I want to try to tell those stories as a way of making a broader argument about the place that people rather than ideas have at the center of this story about the global history of Black people.
Well, that sounds like a really great project, and I certainly look forward to hearing more about it. And I would ask that you definitely consider coming back on the show once it's in book form.
I'd be happy to.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again. You've been listening to Professor Adam Ewing discuss his book, The Age of Garvey, How a Jamaican Activist Created a Mass Movement and Changed Global Black Politics, on the New Books in African American Studies podcast. Thank you and goodbye.